From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. One after another, Enron's former masters of the universe stepped up to the microphone and took the fifth. Their silence was deafening to Enron employees, shareholders, and senators trying to get to the bottom of this mega mess. In this hour, we take an in-depth look at the Fifth Amendment, from roots to present-day reality, how it's been used and abused in the past, and what taking the fifth means today. We begin the hour live in Washington, where another political battle is reaching a climax right now. Congress is in a marathon session voting on campaign finance reform. Karen Forstell is a reporter for the Congressional Quarterly, and she joins us now with the latest developments from the floor. Good evening, Karen.
Good evening, Tom.
Karen, where does the voting on the Shays-Meehan bill stand right now?
Well, so far, Shays-Meehan supporters have been doing pretty well in defeating any amendments they think could kill their legislation. They're right now on the fourth of a total of 13 amendments, and they're going to be voting all through the night. They're predicting the final passage will not happen until about 1 in the morning, possibly as late as 3 this morning.
Karen, does that mean that the base bill has been passed and now it's these amendments that are being added and voted on?
Exactly. The debate started at 10 o'clock this morning. Shays-Meehan supporters were able to defeat two Republican substitutes, and they were able to pass the base bill of Shays-Meehan.
The two substitutes were the ones that were drafted to look tougher, but actually would have led probably to a collapse of anything passing.
Completely.
Ultimately.
In fact, ironically, one of the substitutes was the Shays-Meehan bill that was passed in 1998, and they thought Republican opponents of today's Shays-Meehan bill thought if they bring up an old version of it, they'd be able to get more votes for that and then basically kill the current day Shays-Meehan legislation, but that did not succeed.
So of the 13 amendments, how many are poison pills and how many have been offered by supporters of campaign finance reform?
So-called poison pill amendments, and really opponents of Shays-Meehan, their strategy is to amend the bill as much as possible in order to force a conference committee between the House and Senate. And historically, bills die in conference, so they're hoping to amend it until it has to go to conference. Again, there are 10 so-called poison pill amendments. Mm-hmm. So far, Shays-Meehan supporters have defeated two of those. There are three amendments that Shays-Meehan has said, fine, we can accept these will not be a problem, and they've so far passed one of those.
So there are still seven or eight poison pills to go. How does it look for the pro-reform crowd? Is there still could this still be derailed in this long night of voting?
Most definitely. There's still a lot of obstacles to get through. Again, so far they've done very well. Their numbers have been very solid, particularly on the original passage of Shays-Meehan as the underlying bill. They did very well. They picked up 39 Republicans. This bill is largely supported by Democrats, mm-hmm. but they did pick up 39 Republicans. So those were good numbers for Shays-Meehan supporters. But again, they still have eight more poison pill amendments to go. And even if they're successful in defeating those, this now has to go over to the Senate for final vote. And there's a threatened filibuster in the Senate unless opponents of Shays-Meehan are able to amend this more. So even if they get this through the House, there's still a long road to go in the Senate.
What's the mood on the floor of the House of Representatives as this voting goes on and on?
It's very passionate. Again, they started early at 10 o'clock. They've been going nonstop, and they're going to go until early, early tomorrow morning. So I think as the debate continues, you're really going to start seeing tempers flying, voices getting higher. Already, there's been a lot of very passionate, emotional talk on the floor. Republican leaders, Speaker Dennis Hastert has said if this bill passes, it will spell the end of the Republican majority in the House. And so Republican leaders who oppose this bill are making this a party loyalty vote. And so those Republicans who are supporting Shays-Meehan are saying they're really feeling quite a bit of resentment from their colleagues. One member of Congress, a man from Tennessee, Republican Zach Womp, who is a strong Shays-Meehan supporter, mm-hmm. said every day he goes through the House and says hello to all his colleagues and tries to greet them and be friendly. He says today he's saying hello to a lot of Republicans and they're not answering him.
And Hastert's saying when and if we lose the majority, the Republican majority, it will be your fault.
Exactly. And again, so emotions are running extremely high. And the way they've set up this debate today, they're not allowing any kind of respite. They're not allowing members to even go to dinner. They are holding votes constantly.
What's the point of that? Why not a dinner break, Karen?
Well, I think one of the reasons is, again, strategically, they're hoping hoping that people will just get very tired and stop offering amendments and maybe stop talking so much. And so they're hoping to be able to finish this up at an earlier time. And if you just continue to make people work and work and don't even give them a dinner break, they're hoping they'll tire out quickly. And the debate will end a little bit earlier than 3 in the morning.
Have you spoken with some of the Republicans who defied their leadership and voted for this reform bill? What's their motivation? What's they've got a lot of opposition from their fellow party members. Sure. What's bearing them up?
They're saying it's just a moral issue, that they really feel that so-called soft money, which is the unregulated, unlimited amounts of money that currently go to the national parties, they're saying it's a corrupting influence. And in the past month, they really have been pointing to the Enron situation, saying here is the example. The Enron collapse showed a lot of this political money that was going to federal candidates. In fact, $6 million in soft money was given by Enron employees and the Enron Corporation to federal candidates over the past 10 years. And even though people are saying, well, you can't prove that that money bought them any extra influence, they're saying still, why would Enron be giving $6 million to various candidates?
Fifth Amendment constitutional protection.
Karen Forstell, if this goes through and then gets through the Senate, does this feel like a change of era?
Well, again,
or not.
Republicans, I mean, I think it really could be. Republicans are saying this will be, they're using strong words, they're saying this will be the end of democracy as we know it. So Republican opponents of this certainly
think. The change of a 200-year-plus era.
Exactly. Now, proponents of this bill saying really a lot of what it's doing is shoring up existing law that just has been ignored over the years, and that they're going to just, you know, really go back to what is already in law and clean up the system and make it more democratic. Again, opponents say that it will hurt the federal parties, it will cut back on free speech, it'll hurt outside groups from being able to communicate with the voters. So really both sides say there will be a change in how politics happens. Republicans generally who oppose this bill say it's going to be for the negative.
Karen Forstell, observing the floor of the House of Representatives, where campaign finance reform voting is going on right now. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Karen Forstell is a reporter for the Congressional Quarterly.
After agonizing consideration, I cannot disregard my counsel's instruction. Therefore, I must respectfully decline to answer, on Fifth Amendment grounds, all the questions of this committee and subcommittee, and of those of any other congressional committee and subcommittee. When providing their instruction, my counsel referred me to an excerpt from a unanimous Supreme Court decision of less than a year ago. Quote, one of the Fifth Amendment's basic functions is to protect innocent men. I respectfully ask you not to draw a negative inference because I am asserting my Fifth Amendment constitutional protection.
Enron CEO Kenneth Lay taking the Fifth. In this country, you're innocent until proven guilty. But let's be honest, you sure look guilty when you invoke the Fifth Amendment. Just ask Kenneth Lay or any of the fallen stars of Enron or Ollie North or John Poindexter or anyone refusing to name names during the McCarthy witch hunt. There's a rich tradition of taking the Fifth in American history, and now an equally rich tradition of irate congressmen ripping into mute targets on national television. When someone takes the Fifth, do you assume they're guilty as sin? Do you understand why America's founders built the Fifth Amendment squarely into the Bill of Rights? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from Chevy Chase, Maryland, is Charles Tiefer, professor of law at the University of Baltimore and a former deputy general counsel of the House of Representatives. Good evening and welcome, Charles Tiefer.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And with us in the studio is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Good evening and welcome, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
Charles Tiefer, take us back to the origins of this Fifth Amendment. It's been flying around lately like bats out of a cave. Where did it come from? Why was it central to the Bill of Rights? Why was it so much on the minds of the founders of the Republic?
Well, the words of the Fifth Amendment, which are worth quoting,
please,
are that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. And the historic origins go back even to England, even before the Constitution. pretty much to what was called the Court of Star Chamber, which became a notorious term, in which basic rights were denied, one of them being that a person couldn't refuse to incriminate themselves. And so in repulsion against against the Court of Star Chamber, the tradition began in England and carried over strongly to the U.S. Bill of Rights that experience should not be repeated, and no person should be required in a criminal case to incriminate themselves.
No, just in terms of experience first, what was the experience that was so horrifying? Were people tortured to incriminate themselves or thrown in prison if they wouldn't?
Yes. Torture and so forth were in the background. But there was also a reaction against having an inquisitorial system, which you still find without the torture in continental Europe. The idea that a criminal case should consist of questioning the defendant is something that became abhorrent even without torture in England and America.
And so in legal terms, then, the importance of not having to incriminate oneself out of a judicial tradition, what was the importance? Okay, the thumbscrews won't be put on, but is the thought that, I mean, after all, the person knows or most likely knows what happened. Why shouldn't they tell us?
Well, and that's the argument that's made, say, on the European continent for having their system. But in our system, the notion is that the accused in a case has the whole apparatus of the government against them, all its law enforcement people and its files and its powers and abilities and its ability to gather evidence and witnesses. And so with the whole state and government against the lone individual, it's unfair to make them also have to serve as part of the incrimination system.
Mm-hmm. Was there any question when the American founders included this that it would be there? Was there debate over this, or was it fairly well assumed by enlightened politicians?
I don't think there was much controversy over the basic idea of the Fifth Amendment, but it had a narrow meaning at the time compared to its larger significance today. And I think if they knew at the time the significance it has today, there would have been more controversy.
Like so much of the Constitution, we note from your reading, and of course that was just part of the Fifth Amendment, that the word self-incrimination does not appear in this amendment.
No, that's right. It's just that you not to take place in a criminal case.
So in the case we're looking at now, where the setting has been the Congress in the last week, not a criminal case, how has the Fifth Amendment been extended to the protection of Kenneth Lay and his cohort?
Well, it became fairly well accepted in the 20th century that the Fifth Amendment meant that you didn't have to make statements even outside of a criminal court that could be used against you in the criminal court. And so the Fifth Amendment means for Kenneth Lay that unquestionably doesn't have to make statements at a congressional committee, which the transcript would then be brought over, or the video clip would be brought over and used as Exhibit A in a prosecution of United States versus Kenneth Lay. He doesn't have to give that kind of evidence.
Jack Beatty, it can be infuriating to see the people who know all tell nothing behind the Fifth, but is this at the heart of what it means to be American law?
Well, I think so. People who know about these things say it's really the foundation of the criminal law. For years, people have talked about what will happen if there are ever a referendum on the Bill of Rights. And I've often wondered myself, and I think that the Fifth Amendment is one of those amendments that might not stand. It's not popular with people precisely for this reason. People think he's hiding something, he should answer.
And yet, we've grown up with it. We understand when people take it, there's a protection there.
Yes.
We're talking tonight about the Fifth Amendment, taking the Fifth. It's been taken a lot lately on Capitol Hill, most lately by Enron executives. But there's a rich American history of taking the Fifth. Is it right for the Enron brass to hide behind the Fifth Amendment? Do you understand why America's founders built the Fifth Amendment dodge into the Bill of Rights? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Right now, it's Enron in the hot seat. Back in 1957, it was organized labor. Called to answer questions before the Senate committee, Teamsters President David Beck invoked the Fifth Amendment more than 100 times during the hearings. Here's an excerpt from a blistering exchange between Beck and committee chief counsel Robert Kennedy.
Let me answer it this way. I don't know where you're going or where you intend to go.
Yes,
so
you do.
In all
yes, you
relations,
do, Mr. Beck.
And I say I don't now. I'm not contradicting you. When I don't say that I know when I do not know.
Then answer the question.
All right, I tell you I do not know.
All right, answer the question.
All right, I'm not going to answer the question because I do not know. And I'm going to answer the question in this manner.
All right.
I must decline to answer the question because this committee lacks jurisdiction or authority under Articles 1, 2, and 3 of the Constitution. Further, I decline to answer because I refuse to give testimony against myself and invoke the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, and further, because the question is not relevant or pertinent to the investigation.
In 1959, David Beck was convicted of federal tax evasion and state embezzlement charges and became the first of several Teamsters to end up in prison. But it didn't happen on that day with Robert Kennedy. David Beck took the Fifth with gusto. It's being taken a lot right now, but it doesn't save those who take the Fifth from humiliation on Capitol Hill. There's been that aplenty. What do you think about the Fifth Amendment? Are you glad it's sitting there in the Constitution protecting Americans, yourself included, from having to respond to any question imposed on you by the state? Are you glad for the Fifth Amendment? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Charles Tiefer. He's professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Charles Tiefer, what about this issue of the Fifth Amendment and the norm, or what's become the norm on Capitol Hill these days, where the guy comes in, takes the Fifth, and then doesn't have to say anything about what he knows, but has scorn heaped upon his or her head for the next hour? Is this right?
Well, I myself think that under some circumstances it is right. I thought that it was a proper hearing to have with Ken Lay yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
It did get very controversial, just as you played, in the 1950s, both because of the McClellan Labor Racketeering Committee and, more important, because of the McCarthy-era communist hunting hearings. There, it was an abuse. People would be brought in and called Fifth Amendment communists when they took the Fifth Amendment, or called labor racketeers when they took the Fifth Amendment. And it became so notorious that after the controversial uses in the 1950s, there was another several decades in which you rarely saw witnesses required to take the Fifth in public. They were allowed, if they had to send a letter in or otherwise, but not to have to stand up in front of the public and say, I'm refusing because I would incriminate myself.
In fact, until 1997, there was a rule, was there not, in the House of Representatives, prompted by a suicide of a researcher called to testify by Joseph McCarthy years ago, that for 40 years allowed people to take the Fifth off stage.
That's right. There was a rule which, when I was deputy counsel of the House, I often had to advise about, which required that if a witness who had appeared under subpoena said, I want the cameras turned off, I want the microphones turned off, they had to be shut off.
Mm-hmm. Charles Tiefer, stand by. And Jack Beatty, we're joined now by Samuel Dash. He's professor at the Georgetown University Law Center and was chief counsel of the Senate Watergate Committee. He also served as counsel to Ken Starr during the White Water investigation. Good evening and welcome, Samuel Dash.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Sam Dash, you've seen the parade of Enron executives take the Fifth, with the exception, of course, of former CEO Skilling. And you've seen how the congressmen have come down on them after they've taken the Fifth. It's clearly become a kind of place where you pay a price whether you speak up or not. If you take the Fifth, you also pay a price. You were intimately involved in Watergate and everything around that. What has it left you thinking about the Fifth Amendment and the way it's now treated as a prelude to public scorn?
Well, the Fifth Amendment is really one of the most important rights
in the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution, it doesn't belong to criminals. It belongs to every American citizen, mm-hmm. every person. And it doesn't infer when you take it that you're a criminal. There are all kinds of reasons why you have a reason to take the Fifth Amendment. Mm-hmm. You don't have to explain it. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's actually abuse of process and an outrage that Congress today is forcing a witness in public to take the Fifth Amendment. When I was chief counsel of the Senate Watergate Committee mm-hmm. and researched the law and the role of Congress, I came clearly to the understanding that the only reason Congress has a power that the Supreme Court has supported to investigate and hold public hearings is to serve a legislative function. And that means, the court said, to produce facts that will help it reform legislation or inform the public on how they're being served by their government. Mm-hmm. But they do not have the power, the Supreme Court said in a very major case, to expose people for exposure's sake. And if they're not going to get any relevant facts, they shouldn't call the witness.
So you would say if they're going to take the Fifth, don't even bring them in.
Don't even bring them in. When I was chief counsel, I recommended to Sam Ervin and the committee that on that basis and in respect for the Fifth Amendment and our Constitution, that we do call them in executive session or mm-hmm. in depositions. And if they take the Fifth there privately, then they have asserted their constitutional right. There's no legislative purpose served by calling them in public, and we excused them. And we excused some very notorious people who would have made, very interesting and exciting witnesses as they sat there and sweated while we asked dirty questions and they took the Fifth. But we didn't think that was right. That's not the way the American Constitution allows us to do it. Mm-hmm. And Senator Ervin, who I think has been one of the best senators in the history of the United States and mm-hmm. ran a very remarkable, successful hearings in Watergate, accepted that. The committee accepted that. And you never saw, when you were watching the televised hearings of the Watergate hearing, any witness called in public session to take the Fifth. It really is wrong. Mm. And the Supreme Court said so. I'm waiting for a lawyer to raise that question before the committee. Yes, they'll hold the witness in contempt if he refuses to take the Fifth before the committee and refuses to answer. But I think a court and the Supreme Court would uphold him under the Watkins decision, which says you just don't call somebody before Congress to expose them for exposure's sake. That's what Joe McCarthy did during those dirty hearings that he held, in which he ruined reputations and finally was thrown out of office.
Sam Dash, we got your point and we hear your passion behind it. We're paying special attention as you were chief counsel in the Senate Watergate Committee, sort of in the middle of the mother of all scandals. But Jack Beatty, there's a very different role here today. The public excoriation of folks who are not convicted but are seen in a bad light is goes on in great high dudgeon, has this week certainly. Does that unsettle you, or do you see that as if people take the Fifth, at least they pay a price in public reputation?
Well, it didn't seem to unsettle the senators. Only one member of that committee of 23 people had taken no contributions in the last 10 years from either Enron or its accountant, Arthur Anderson. So there's only one person there, Dan, anyway, of Hawaii, who, without any feeling of irony, could inveigh against Mr. Lay. I think there's a quality here of sort of a ritual of degradation, and I agree with Mr. Dash that this is probably not the way courts or inquests should proceed. But I must admit, to see Mr. Lay there, having these senators call him worst carnival barker, you know, worst schemer since Charles Ponzi, various species of contemptible beast, it appealed to my Schadenfreude. I wanted him to squirm, and that probably is an impulse that the law will seek to, you know, to sublimate. But it's there, and just to see this man having to take that tongue lashing was worth something, I think.
Charles Tiefer, where do you stand on this? Is the tongue lashing handed out to people who take the Fifth on Capitol Hill now a kind of a political bread and circus, a kind of gladiator savagery, or do you think it falls within appropriate and legal behavior when someone's taken the Fifth?
Well, I think that we have developed since the Watergate hearings of 1973 something of a counter-tradition. Mm-hmm. There were at least three major scandals in the 1980s in which witnesses publicly famous witnesses publicly were required to and did take the Fifth Amendment.
This is Iran-Contra.
Oliver North and John Poindexter in Iran-Contra.
Mm-hmm.
Former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Sam Pierce in the HUD scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And the billionaire Michael Milken in the junk bond scandal.
Right.
Were all obliged to take the Fifth publicly. I don't think the judgment of history in retrospect has been that those hearings were at all like the 1950s McCarthy hearings. Those were the new tradition, the 1980s tradition I'm talking about, uses the central major figure taking the Fifth to clarify the issues, that it cuts through. Instead of losing people in mind-numbing accounting discussions
mm-hmm.
about partnership,
mm-hmm.
You get a powerful comparison. Some people are able to answer questions, like Berardino of Arthur Andersen, their chief executive
mm-hmm.
officer,
mm-hmm.
but the CEO of Enron could not. And
well, can I butt in here?
Yes, Sam Dash.
Sam Dash. I disagree. I do not believe this is a new tradition. I believe it's a backward trend, or it comes from ignorance of the Supreme Court's decision and the role of Congress. I stand by what I said. Congress has a constitutional responsibility of oversight and to investigate and hold hearings.
Mm.
But the Supreme Court has said over and over again, only if they act within their legislative function. Clearly, calling a witness before televised cameras solely to take the Fifth Amendment and not provide any information to the committee is not serving a legislative purpose. It's serving only one purpose, and that's to humiliate the witness. Congress does not have that power. That's abuse of power. That's outrageous.
Charles
and
Tiefer, that sounds like something ripe for a challenge, Charles Tiefer, but that we haven't seen one, at least not that I know of.
I don't care whether anybody challenges it or not. I'm saying that Congress has no right to do it under the law. And as I was chief counsel, and I worked with a very fine committee, and not the old-fashioned committee, and not in an old tradition or a new
yes.
tradition,
mm.
our committee were some of the finest senators in the country, and they took the position rightly, at my recommendation, that you don't do that sort of thing.
So,
I think senators are doing it now, are not adopting it under a policy position,
mm-hmm.
but they're doing it just to get their a high circus show business on television without performing any legislative function. That's not their role. They're out of order, and they ought to be reprimanded for it.
Well, there is plenty of showbiz. Charles Tiefer, I know we have to let you go. A last word before you do?
Well, first of all, I think the world of the Watergate Committee in general and of its chief counsel, Sam Dash in particular, who has been a consistent civil libertarian,
mm-hmm.
and he speaks well with it here, too. I would say that at least the people who we're bringing on now, like Ken Lay, are high figures, major figures, like North was, like Milken was, like Pierce was.
Mm-hmm.
They can take the heat. They are not being crushed like little people were. And I think, therefore, that they are like people, I might say, in court cases, as long as they are civil, not criminal, it has been considered to serve an evidentiary function.
No, you cannot draw an inference from asserting the Fifth. The Supreme Court has ruled that over and over again. There's no evidentiary value in a Fifth Amendment assertion, and no fact or inference can be drawn from it by the jury.
In a civil case, there is.
No, there
is. In a civil case, if the defendant takes, the jury is entitled to know that the defendant is refusing to answer questions on the grounds of the Fifth Amendment.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to let that be settled off. Offline, Charles Tiefer, I know you have to go. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Charles Tiefer is a former deputy counsel, general counsel of the House of Representatives and professor of law at the University of Baltimore. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's bring them in. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Good evening. Nice to talk to you.
Pleasure.
I must say that this program has gotten my blood pressure slightly elevated.
All right. Talk to us, Tom.
One of the salient points of this right of a person to refuse to, and you've got to remember the word is tend to incriminate.
Now, by the way, can I correct that? The
Sam
Constitution
Dash.
Says no person may be required to be a witness against themselves. There's
okay.
nothing in the Constitution that speaks of incrimination.
Mm-hmm.
You may not be compelled to be a witness against yourself.
Okay. Well, But
where's your concern, Tom?
My concern is that that this is not an amendment that was designed to protect the famous, the or the infamous. It was designed to protect common everyday citizens all over the world, all over this country, who by being questioned judiciously and cleverly by attorneys can be made to answer questions that would make them appear to be guilty of something.
Now, that's an interesting point. Sam Dash, what about it? Is there any difference under the Constitution between famous, infamous, and common Americans?
The Fifth Amendment has nothing to do with whether it's an ordinary person who may not be knowledgeable in the law or have a bright lawyer, or a very famous person. The Fifth Amendment has been approved and accepted. The Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court can take the Fifth. The President of the United States can take the Fifth.
Mm-hmm.
The Fifth Amendment comes all the way from early history,
mm-hmm.
When we began to get confessions from people by the use of the rack and screw and torture.
Yeah.
In our Constitution, we took the position, and it was English history as well, that you do not prove your case through forcing somebody to give testimony. That is a civilized, democratic process in which you prove your case by producing evidence against them. The courts have traditionally said that. It isn't that by saying that a person has a right to take the Fifth Amendment, that we're approving of the individual, or that if he's committed crimes, he should get away with it. As a matter of fact, that even in criminal cases, the Fifth Amendment is recognized, but a good prosecutor doing a good investigation can get facts around the individual. You don't have to get the individual to be a witness against himself.
Sam Dash, when you've seen the parade of Enron executives go through taking the Fifth, does that look to you like that's just the way it ought to be, or does it seem like an abuse of the amendment?
I think it's an abuse of the amendment. There's no reason to call these people.
On the part of the executives themselves, when you see them take the Fifth, does that look to you as an attorney like a good idea, or do you think, well, they're hiding?
Yes, it is, because I've represented some very prominent people, both in congressional investigations and at trials, in which it was my considered judgment in their best interest to advise them not to answer questions and take the Fifth. But what I'm saying is, mm-hmm. when we're dealing with the congressional situation, what's the purpose of calling Ken Lay before the committee and forcing him to take the Fifth in public? What do they gain from that that allows them to learn information that will allow them to give us better legislation or to inform the public how they are being served or whether or not we need corporate reform or accountant reform? You get zero information.
Sam Dash, we've got your point. We've got to take a break. It appears that they may not get what you're looking for, but they do get a lot of media attention. And in this age, that plays a big role as well. We'll come back and talk about that. We're talking about the Fifth Amendment. Have you taken it? Would you take it? And what do you think of the Enron executives who have? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about taking the Fifth. It's been taken a lot lately on Capitol Hill. What do you think? Are the congressional hearings pointless if the Enron chieftains just take the Fifth? Are you glad to see the men of Enron raked over the coals by congressmen, even when they take the Fifth? Or is that an abuse of the amendment of the constitutional guarantee that they shall not be be drawn into self-incrimination, and as our guest Samuel Dash says tonight, even more, that the Congress not be used just as a kind of whipping post for folks when the information is not leading toward a criminal.
Making laws.
Toward making law. Thank you, Jack Beatty, rescuing me there. That's the question tonight. And Jack Beatty, I guess one thing that comes to mind is the one Enron executive who did not take the Fifth, Jeffrey Skilling. Why not?
Well, I don't know, but he's left himself open to perjury charges, apparently, because some of the things that he said to the committee under oath are contradicted by contemporaneous witnesses who have different recollections. So here's a man who, you know, we could say he disregarded. It struck me that Ken Lay was trying to put it off on his lawyer. He was sort of trying to represent himself.
I'd really love to talk.
I'd really love to tell you the truth here and to show and to stand up under these charges. But this lawyer of mine, he just says, no, you can't do it. Well, Skillings took the opposite position and said, I'm going to stand here and answer anything. And he may have got himself into a heck of a lot of trouble as a result. One more point about a question Tom raised, which is the lone small individual and how this amendment protects him. You know, the worldview of the founders is so important here. Bernard Bailyn, the colonial historian, says that the sort of inner drive of American political culture inculcated, put into it by the founding fathers, is the belief that power is evil. Just power is evil. And the Bill of Rights is like a castle that protects ordinary people against the government's power, and which is intrinsically, according to the Founding Fathers, evil, because it is the rack, it is the screw, it is, you know, pressure on people, it is collective responsibility.
Take your house, take your home.
Yeah, everything. Take your family. And it's right there in that amendment, you know.
Jack Beatty and Sam Dash, a former chief counsel in the Senate Watergate Committee, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to come in. We have another Tom on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Tom.
Okay, fantastic. Quick question and then a comment, and I'll get off to hear your comments. One, I'd like to hear Mr. Dash's comments on, and I should know the answer to this as an attorney, but mostly on the corporate side. Why is it, I believe, that in a criminal grand jury convening, a witness who's compelled to testify, I understand, cannot take the Fifth, and if they attempt to do so, the DA or whoever is investigating the grand jury can hold them in contempt and be
a crime.
Set it straight, Sam Dash.
A witness called before the grand jury has a right to take the Fifth, and if he takes the Fifth, he's excused. The only time that the prosecutor can hold some, try to get a contempt action, as it happened with Susan McDonald, is she was given immunity. Hmm. If you grant somebody immunity, then that's a swap for the Fifth Amendment. You no longer have the Fifth Amendment because you're not going to be in trouble. Then you, when you're asked questions, you have to answer, and failure to answer is grounds for contempt. Mm. But nobody can be held in contempt for asserting the Fifth. That is a Bill of Rights that every American has, and if they assert it, they have to be excused.
Mm. Tom, thanks for the call. Samuel Dash, what about when folks are taking the Fifth? Does it suggest, the point of it is to say, if you think I'm guilty, government, prosecutor, you prove it. I don't have to tell you anything.
That basically is our system of justice.
Mm-hmm. But this drives it home.
But in addition, these cases like Enron or any major white-collar crime or scandal are involved with very complex matters. And a lawyer who investigates these matters and is representing a client, the client may say, I didn't do anything wrong. I want to testify. The lawyer would say, you may not have done anything wrong, but there are all kinds of links and chains and innuendos that if you start talking to these people who are not interested in helping you but only hurting you, you're going to get yourself in trouble. Even your reputation will be hurt if they can't, you know, convict you. But you will be being a witness against yourself. Let me tell you this. Mm-hmm. That the hardest thing for a lawyer to do with a prominent business figure or public official who has been subpoenaed to testify in a grand jury or before a congressional committee to persuade the person not to testify. Mm-hmm. These people say, I don't want to look like a criminal. I want to clear myself.
Right.
And the lawyer has to sit on them and say, that's not the way the system works. You're going to get yourself in trouble.
It's the wrong instinct.
And so it really isn't right to draw the inference that because someone took the Fifth Amendment, they really have some crime to hide.
And yet we do. Sam Dash, stand by. Dan is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Dan, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
Notwithstanding the coerced aspect of this history of the thing and the political shenanigans that you folks are talking about, I'm a criminal defense lawyer in Erie.
Okay.
One of the things you have to remember is you have police officers who may rely on a confession that may not be correct. And then they get a little sloppy because it's our system that the police and the investigative agencies have to prove the case.
So you're saying it keeps police on their toes when they can't count on someone incriminating themselves.
Well, yeah, because, you know, look at the spate of DNA releases that we have throughout the country of people that are convicted of rapes, murders, and then suddenly 10 or 15 years later, they are now been released because the DNA tests come back positive, come back negative. And if you look at those cases further, most of them have some sort of a confession, which lead the police on the wrong path.
Dan, that's a fascinating point. Let me put it to Sam Dashen. Thanks for your call. Sam, Dan is saying it keeps the law enforcement authorities honest. It keeps them doing their job.
When I was district attorney of Philadelphia, I've prosecuted as much as I've defended. Mm-hmm. And when I was district attorney of Philadelphia, what I learned was that when you had a lawyer on the other side who was advising the client, it made me, as a prosecutor, and it made the police who were working with me, much more careful in how we prepared our case.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, when you had somebody, and even if you're honest, and even you feel yourself fair, if you have somebody who isn't being protected, in those days, I'm talking about the 1950s, when people didn't have a right to a lawyer, if somebody wasn't protected and you and it was easier for you to go ahead, you got sloppy and you got careless.
And you push them,
I
suppose.
The only way our system of justice will work is to challenge the prosecutor, challenge the investigator, challenge the government, and make them prove their case. And don't try to do it the easy way. As they used to say in the Indian investigations in India, they would dig the guy a hole in the sand. They would bury him in the sand with just his head showing, put honey on his face, and let the ants eat him until he confessed. Well, you know, that was the way they thought was efficient.
Sounds like the U.S. House of Representatives in Congress lately, Sam. Sam Dash, we're out of time. Sam Dash was the chief counsel on the Senate Watergate Committee. He's a professor at the Georgetown University Law Center. Samuel Dash, we thank you very much for joining us tonight. Jack Beatty, final thought on the workhorse of the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment. You ready to take it?
I'm ready to take it. Well, you know, one thing is for sure. In the 50s, there was a jibe that leftist writers, you know, so enjoyed taking the Fifth that there was subpoena envy. There'll be no subpoena envy among these executives.
I don't think so. And little envy, perhaps, of Jeff Skilling as this all goes forward for his bravura refusal to take the Fifth. Jack, thanks very much for being in studio with us tonight.
Thank you.
For ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Since September 11th, categories of popular hero have emerged from the rubble of the attacks on America and the war on terror, troops and firefighters in particular. Bill Barbeau fought in Vietnam, helped train troops during Desert Storm, and today works as a firefighter for the Somerville Fire Department's Engine 4. He shared the pain he still has from his Vietnam days in one of the 17 prayers put to music in the latest CD of Suzzy Roach called Zero Church. We met recently with Bill Barbeau at the firehouse to hear his thoughts on killing in Vietnam and now saving lives in Somerville, Massachusetts.
I decided to volunteer for Vietnam because my father had been a World War II vet, and I felt it was part of your rite of passage into manhood was to, when the war came along, it was you go to war. You live or die as you go to war.
As a young man, I killed.
One of the things that haunt me to this day is I was leading a patrol. My dog was misbehaving. Anyway, we crossed this big open area, these rice paddies. We come to the tree line, and there's a bunch of fallen trees, and he was going under a tree trunk, so we get all tangled up. And he starts pulling. I can't see why he's pulling me. I moved a branch to one side, and there's a man standing about 100 feet, not even that, away from me, less than that, with a rifle on his shoulder. It's the enemy. He looks down his sights, He pulls the trigger. It misfired. He should have ran. Because right then and I started pulling the trigger. The shotgun was all tangled up in the brush and the vines. And I caught him with the very last round. I caught a little bit of him in the shoulder and knocked him over. I got loose. I let the dog go, loaded the weapon, and then I shot him to little tiny pieces. Nobody recognized him as a human being. While all of this is going on, the infantry is shooting. There's rounds flying everywhere. The bullets are flying everywhere. They're shooting at the countryside. They don't know what they're shooting at, but I opened up, so they opened up. When the smoke cleared, we had killed a bunch of those people that day. I used to have crying fits every once in a while, bringing up my kids. I lost my temper, I hair trigger. But I didn't realize what was really going on. There's something wrong with me until I got in a real bad motorcycle accident. It was 18 months getting back to work. And during that time, I had that some time to think and reflect. And I called a friend of mine who's a little further down the road with post-traumatic stress than I am, and he recommended I see a vet counselor. And I've been seeing Tom for 2 years.
I will try to do good things to my fellow human beings, like nursing, fighting fire, and save lives. It's what I know.
I've always been a risk taker, I think, and I became a firefighter because it was an exciting job. But over the years, as I evolved, I got a little smarter. And I think now that was part of this atonement also. Again, you want to live in this society, if you're going to give up killing. And for me, the best thing to do is to go out there and help people. And I don't have the temper to be a cop. So firefighting was good. Because every time we go out the door, we're going out to help somebody's in trouble, and we're going out to help them. And then after 9/11, when New York City lost them 300-some-odd guys, it was, wow. They would die doing their job. If you're going to die, that's a good way to die. It's doing your job. And people now, yeah, we've gotten a little bit of notoriety, and people come up and say thank you. And, you know, if I wear my uniform going to and from work, I'm recognized now out of the crowd. And I guess that's nice, I guess. It's good for them. Nice.
Bill Barbeau is a firefighter in Somerville, Massachusetts. We want to hear your stories on our show. Radio Diaries begin with an email or a letter from you. They start as an essay of up to 800 words. We want to hear about how your lives intersect with what happens in the news. You can email us at onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.